You're listening to a podcast by the Perennial Leader Project. To learn more, visit perennial.substack.com. Welcome back to another episode of In Search of Wisdom. Today, my guest is Todd May, author of A Decent Life, Morality for the Rest of Us. Todd is a philosopher and author of 18 books, including A Significant Life, A Fragile Life, and many others. He worked as a philosophical advisor on the hit show The Good Place and has written extensively on meaning, friendship, fragility, and other topics. One quick announcement before we get started. If you're not already a subscriber to Perennial Meditations on Substack, I encourage you to do so. You'll help support my work and gain access to the daily meditations I send out, as well as a book club called Reading in the Good Life. We're actually just starting a new book, which is The Art of Solitude by Stephen Batchelor. And we're getting ready to kick off a new course called Perennial Habits, exploring the art and science of lifelong practices. You can visit perennial.substack.com to subscribe and learn more. All right, without any further delay, I now bring you the wise and gracious Todd May. So Todd May, welcome to In Search of Wisdom.
It's great to be here, Josh.
It's good to have you. I'm excited to chat about your book, A Decent Life, Morality for the Rest of Us. But before we get into the book, we generally take a moment and try to get to know you a little bit. Would you mind sharing how you initially found an interest in philosophy?
Well, I was in psychology, actually. I have most of a PhD in psychology, but I was starting to raise a set of philosophical questions about the practice of psychology. And long story short, I was thrown out of psych grad school and then thought, well, maybe I'll go study philosophy. And what I found, Josh, is that in philosophy, they'll take anybody as long as they're willing to make an argument, right? So, I went into philosophy, studied the French philosopher Michel Foucault, got a PhD, and then have been, I wrote a lot of around French philosophy early on in my career. Later on, the book that you read is from thinking about issues in life that were important to me. And those are the kinds of things I started writing about.
I'm curious, for anybody listening, when you think about discerning a particular path in life, maybe the psychology department in this example helped you kind of make that decision in one way, but I'm sure it's a difficult decision, and I'm sure you deal with this when it comes for upcoming books and writing and projects that you're doing. How do you think about just discerning what's worth doing, what's not?
Well, Josh, to be honest, it's harder now than it was when I was growing up. Right? When I was young, you could get a job that paid minimum wage a little higher, afford a place to live. So you could bounce around. I went through several things before I found my way into grad school in psychology before philosophy. So I think it's harder for younger people now because rents are higher, jobs are more scarce. Internships that used to be paid internships are now unpaid internships. So my experience, I think, is a more difficult experience for younger folks. Nevertheless, it's easy, I think, sometimes to feel the pressure to take a career and figure it out early. But that career you're going to be doing for maybe 30, 40 years. So if you can afford to take time one way or the other, I think it's always a good idea. Take some time, read some books, think about what you want to do, and then move from there.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Todd. And that's maybe a good transition into the book. And before we touch on what you mean by the title, A Decent Life, I thought it could be helpful to touch on a few philosophical positions that you reference in the book, things like consequentialism, deontology, virtue ethics. Could you touch on a few of these things before we get into it?
Sure. Moral theory, Western moral theory, is generally divided into three types. Used to be two, but now there's a third. Used to be, it was a debate between consequentialists and deontologists. Consequentialists thought that what makes an action right are the results of the consequences of the action, how it turns out, what effects it has. For the deontologists, it's not the results or the consequences that matter. It's the means. It's oftentimes the intentions that are morally relevant. And that, so there's a debate between means and ends that was for several hundred years was going on in moral philosophy. But way back in Aristotle's time, Aristotle developed another way of thinking about philosophy. I'm sorry, another way of thinking about ethics. And this wasn't the consequences or the intentions of your action, but what kind of person you wanted to be. This idea was recovered in the 40s, 1940s, 1950s, and really brought to prominence in the 1980s. And it became known as virtue ethics. So virtue ethics focuses on the kinds of characteristics, virtues, that you want to cultivate in yourself as an ongoing project in your life, rather than looking at specific actions and asking, what are the best consequences or what are the intentions behind them?
In the way of figures within these particular positions, like you mentioned in terms of Aristotle, virtue ethics, and maybe deontology, most well-known, I guess, would be Kant. But what about consequentialists? Who are some of the figures that adopt this view?
Probably the most famous one, the one students are most likely to run across, is John Stuart Mill. Mill has a little book, Utilitarianism, that's commonly used in courses on ethics and moral philosophy. He was preceded by Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham is this interesting figure. His body is kept in Westminster Cathedral and brought out once a year, I think on his birthday. And they couldn't preserve his head. So my understanding is when they bring him out annually, they have a plastic head that they put on Bentham, and then they shove him back into his crypt for the rest of the year. People may have heard of Bentham. The person they're most likely to know is John Stuart Mill.
What and why a decent life, if you could, to kick us off here?
Okay, Josh. Well, let me tell you the backstory here. Right? Yeah. The backstory is I had written a number of books, and the last two I'd written for the University of Chicago Press, A Significant Life, about what makes life meaningful, A Fragile Life, about how we think about and deal with suffering. And I told the editor, I'm out of ideas. I got nothing. I think my writing career has just come to an end. And she said, look, let me call you and let's talk about this a little bit. So she called me up and she said, Todd, I was thinking to myself, what book would you write that I would want to read? And she asked me, do you know Peter Singer? So also a utilitarian, right? Do you know the thought of Peter Singer? Right? She says, do you know his book, The Most Good You Can Do? Which is about what's now currently very fashionable, called effective altruism, acting in such a way as to cause the best consequences, sometimes sacrificing your a kidney for someone else, going to Wall Street and making a lot of money just so you can give it away. Those are the kinds of ideas he was considering in this book. She said, do you know The Most Good You Can Do? I said, yeah, I do. She said, I would like you to write that book. I would like you to write The Most Good You Could Do for Sane People. And immediately I knew what she was talking about, that this is just not how most of us live our moral lives. But maybe there's a way to frame how most of us live our moral lives that won't be the maximum good we can do, that won't be the best possible Aristotelian person we can be, that won't be the best Kantian we can be, but that we'll frame it in such a way that we can understand how we move through the world and give us some steps that we might take to extend that a little bit without asking us to be morally perfect people.
It's a fascinating thing, and I'm glad you wrote the book. I really enjoyed it. And I'm curious if we could stay here and chat about this particular thing for a bit. In some of those philosophical schools that you kind of touched on. You might think of Aristotle, such a thing as like the highest good, certain things and traditions of where you might look up to a particular sage or saint as this like ideal. You know, how do you navigate that in the way of like the ideal, the highest good? You know, what would you say there?
Josh, I don't think there's anything wrong with having an ideal, but I think oftentimes having an ideal can be dangerous. Like, you can have an ideal that you look up to and that you model yourself after, but you can also have an ideal that you use to berate yourself as not being good enough. And this is particularly the case, I think, with a lot of forms of consequentialism, that people think, I need to think about the best consequences. I need to consider all the factors. I did something. It didn't have the consequences I wanted. What does that say about me as a person? So I think having ideals on the one hand can be helpful guides, but I think they can be dangerous on the other. And at one point in the book, I say, if we're not berating ourselves by what we're missing, what we're not doing well enough, maybe that opens up the possibility of moving through the world with a certain, I use the term moral gracefulness, so that rather than thinking of morality as a burden, you know, using traditional terms like duty and obligation, we can think of it as a possible way of incorporating being better into our lives such that we feel good about what we're doing and good about having some of the effects we're having, rather than feeling bad because or guilty because we're falling short.
Yeah, it seems to be such an important point. I'm a big fan of the Stoic philosopher Seneca. We do a thing where it's read one of his letters each week. But if you don't have that forgiveness piece, that, you know, a bit of grace for yourself, because you essentially in the virtue ethics, many of the Hellenistic philosophical schools, which we've chatted about on this podcast many times, it's like you're going to miss the mark. It's like it's not necessarily that highest good is not necessarily something you hit out of the park every day, you know. So it's like, how do you deal with that? And I was thinking about like the adage in the way of starting a project or anything like that, of like perfection is the enemy of the good, this common thing that most people have heard. But it seems like this is like a great example of applying it to life as well. Is it a case against the perfectionism type of thing that we so easily fall into?
I think it's partly a case against the perfectionism with which we berate ourselves. It's also partially a case against thinking of morality as always overriding. Right? The philosopher Susan Wolf, that I quote a number of times in that book, she's got a great perspective on the idea that moral values are important, but they aren't always overriding. And if we think of moral values as always overriding, then that's when the problem of the moral perfectionism starts to eat away at us. So we can think of morality as having an important role to play in our lives, but we can think of having other values as well. For instance, in his famous article, Famine, Affluence, and what was it, Pamela Emphasis and Morality, I think, Peter Singer talks about not contributing to like the opera while people are starving, not contributing to cultural goods because there are much more urgent needs out there. But if we imagine a life without any of these cultural goods, maybe we haven't done the best overall good for humanity, but something gets impoverished as well. Wolf has her finger on that our lives can't always be driven by moral concerns. And the perfectionism that morality sometimes commends to us, I think, is a perfectionism that will lend itself to making morality dominate everything else. Right? Mm. And once it does, I think our lives become impoverished, and I think our relationships become impoverished, even if we're causing more overall good.
I'm curious your thoughts of this approach to other perennial questions. You think of like know thyself, or, you know, what is the meaning of life? I was recently watching Steve Martin's documentary that and you know, he's talking about knowing yourself, and it's, he's saying, even now I don't know myself, you know, and it reminds me of something I read a few years back around, I think it was from the psychologist Thomas More, talking about only the shallow know themselves. Basically, it's very, very difficult to like truly know yourself. Like, how do you actually know that? And he suggests that many of his patients are, you know, they come to some sort of certainty, come to some sort of like, I've checked that box, I guess, if you will, in terms of I know myself. It's like, could you take a similar approach to some of these other, you know, perennial questions, like know thyself, for example?
Well, I think know thyself is a good example, not only of taking that position, but of having to take that position, regardless of the position you think you're taking. Right. So, for instance, I often say to my classes that people's ability knowingly to do evil, to say this is evil and I'm going to do it, is fairly limited. I think we do have some politicians that may be pressing on that, but generally it's fairly limited. However, people's capacity for self-deception seems pretty much infinite. And so I think it's nearly impossible to know oneself, but I think it's also the case that self-deception is not always a bad thing. Self-deception about things that aren't debilitating for our lives can save us from a lot of anxiety and shame. So it seems to me, that's almost impossible, if not impossible, really to know ourselves completely, because we deceive ourselves about a variety of things. And B, that's not necessarily a problem. There are forms of self-deception that we probably ought to address, but there are probably other forms of self-deception that are, they're not a problem. They may be good for preserving us.
And how about, you know, just in the way of finding meaning or making meaning in life, you know, how do you think about that, Tom?
Well, I have a book about it, Josh. Yeah. Right. The significant life is arguing that there is at least one way of thinking about meaningfulness in a life that hasn't really been considered. It's not happiness and it's not moral rightness. It's something else. It has some kinship with Aristotle, but I think it's different. The idea is that our lives may have various themes, loyalty, intensity, adventurousness, spirituality, curiosity, things like that. And those themes might lend a certain meaningfulness to our lives, give them a certain shape that we look at and say, yeah, this is a way I'd want to live, that allows us to move beyond the am I good, am I happy distinction. And yet and still, I don't want to argue that is what makes life mean. That is the meaning of life, right? It seems to me that's one way that people have not thought about that can help give a sense of meaningfulness to a life. But I'm sure that there are others. And if we start thinking about it in that way, I'm going to use the philosophical term pluralistically, right? Doesn't reduce to a single thing, right? But there are plural ways of thinking about meaningfulness. If we start thinking about meaning pluralistically, then I don't think we're less driven to say, okay, here's the meaning and that's the thing I got to find and be.
Yeah. Nice. And to transition to a couple chapters in the book, you talk about widening our circle, widening the circle. And could you say a bit about this idea of widening the circle to those distant from us in space and time?
Yeah. So the first step of widening the circle is to move out from people you know to people you interact with, and you don't. They're strangers, but you have face to face interaction. And I use a couple of examples there. I'll mention that one example that seemed to creep people out was one that I kind of liked, which was somebody is sitting in a meeting with you, and they have a hot cup of coffee, and they leave the room to go to the bathroom, and you take a napkin and you put it over their hot cup of coffee is to keep the coffee hot. And some people thought that that was adorable. And other people thought I would never drink a cup of coffee like that. But that's where you have strangers that with face-to-face interaction. But there are going to be people in the world that are currently existing that you'll never run into, that you might or might not have effects on. And then there are people who are not currently existing in the world, but who will come to exist. Those are people down the road. Now, to be a little careful about that, it's not that there are current people that don't exist that will exist, right? It's not like there's Fred here in germ, right, who's going to get born, right? But there will be people down the road.
Right? Yeah.
And if we don't take account of those people who will be here down the road, we're going to run headlong into things like the climate crisis, which is going to give them a much worse capacity to live a happy, meaningful, or flourishing life. And that's something we need to take into account. It doesn't mean we have to sacrifice ourselves completely for them, but we have to act in such a way as to take them into account. And that goes back to what I said in the very first chapter, that a decent life is fundamentally about recognizing that there are other human beings or will be other human beings, and that they have lives to live. They fear death. They mostly don't want to be alone. They need basic resources in order to live, and that we should take that into account in our actions. Well, there's going to be people, and there currently are people who have lives that I might affect even if I never meet them, or alternatively, that I can affect in a positive way even if I never meet them. And to the extent to which we reasonably can, we should take those people into account. Recognize there are people that either could use some help in the terms of some money of mine, could use some political solidarity of mine, and it isn't going to destroy my life, and I'm not going to have to be a perfect person in order to offer that to them. So if we think we share the planet with people, right, who are human beings like us, right, who have lives to live, and I should take that into account as I'm moving through the world, and there will be people who will come to exist, who will have lives to live, and I should take that into account as I move through the world.
Such an important point. It's strange in a way that it's so easy to forget. You think of like 1,000 years in the past and 1,000, years forward. There's obviously wisdom of being here in the present moment. You and I, focused on this conversation, but there's also, seems to be a lot of wisdom in reflecting and, thinking about all sorts of things that are not necessarily right here, in front of you in this, present moment.
Well, there was a psychology teacher that I had at the grad school before I got thrown out.
Yeah.
And he said one of the most difficult things for people to do is to recognize that there's other folks out there. Of course, he didn't mean that we can't see other people and recognize their bodies, but to recognize that there are people with different perspectives, different ways of taking up the world, and they're not illegitimate simply because they are different. And that seems to me a bit of wisdom. And it's one that I think any successful marriage is going to have to navigate sooner or later.
Yeah. And the next chapter talks about widening the circle, which I love, to non-human animals. Could you say a bit about that, Todd?
Yeah, yeah. And I talk about our cat that died. but I can talk here from personal experience, because I grew up without pets. I grew up in New York City. I grew up without pets. I've never had a sense of a deep relationship, right, with other animals. And still, as I started to study this and think about it, did what I do when I'm trying to think through an issue, which is I taught courses about it. I taught courses on animal rights and began to see that animals have much richer and more sophisticated lives in many different ways than we traditionally accord them. And that philosophy over the bulk of its its career has afforded them. So it seemed to me then that although they have lives that are different from ours, they have lives that involve sentience, that have things that can be good for them, that have things that can be bad for them, and that this is worth taking into account as well. And people take it into account in different ways. I took it into account minimally with our cat for a number of years, which is to say, when the rest of the family went away for a few days, I didn't starve the cat. I fed the cat, made sure it had water and things like that. And toward the end of the cat's life, you know, I sort of developed more sympathy for it, and then may have had some effect on my general relationship to animals. But just as human beings have lives lived, so do most non-human animals. And there's no harm in taking that into account. There's no harm in recognizing that we can do things to make them suffer, and we can do things to make them flourish, and to one extent or another, that's probably something that we ought to do. So let me swing back to people and back to animals then again, right? The great homeless advocate, a guy named Mitch Snyder, many years ago, said that when you see a homeless person, you may not be able to give them something, but they're a person, they're a human being, they have feelings, right? And so I try, but if I see a person who seems unhoused, right? If I don't have, I'll carry around a couple bucks, but if they don't have money, just even go up to them and say, look, I'm sorry, I don't have anything. If things are tough, I hope things are okay, right? That's a person that's easy to walk away from, right? To walk past, pretend, you know, see, you know, you're uncomfortable, it feels awkward. Well, that if that's the case with a human being where you might feel awkward, and yet you're willing to say something that acknowledges their being, why not a non-human animal, right? Doesn't mean you have to pet it, right? Doesn't mean you have to take care of it, but recognize, hey, there are humans out there, right, that it may be awkward and different for me to try to acknowledge them, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't acknowledge them, right? And there are non-human animals out there that it may be awkward and different for me to try to acknowledge them, but that doesn't mean I shouldn't acknowledge them in some form or another. And again, Josh, it's not like we have to be like perfect. We don't have to like take every stray cat out there, right? Get it spayed and take care of it. But right, we can recognize, right, that there are in different ways that these non-human animals, right, have lives to live. So in my case, one of the things that I did is I am mostly a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. I'll eat fish every once in a while. And I'm not a perfect vegetarian, right? I put cream in my coffee sometimes that is probably coming from a farm that I shouldn't be buying from, things like that. This is the decent but not perfect part, right? But I do that in a recognition that these animals have lives, and I don't need to be subjecting them to the horrible lives that factory farm animals have in order to get my nourishment or even in order to enjoy my food. Now, Josh, having said that, I will say this, that people have asked me, they said, Todd, you're mostly a vegetarian, and you don't really like animals, right? Like, how is it that you reconcile that? And my response, Josh, is, yeah, look, there's a lot of people I don't like either, but I don't feel the need to eat them, right? So I don't see a deep tension here between my relation to animals, right, and my relation to other human beings.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's interesting in the way of just, an acknowledgement and awareness of what might be going on. I'm thinking about, you know, the house we live in, and then up the road, they're building a big housing development, you know, and obviously clearing away all sorts of the stuff, and in the process, you know, ending the lives and relocating all sorts of, you know, critters and animals and all sorts of stuff that we're not even aware of. But and obviously we did the same thing in the house that, you know, we live in at some point in time, but just in an awareness of our connectedness with so many, you know, people, things, non-human animals, all, you know, all sorts of stuff. It's another thing that just seems like easy to forget, easy to look past.
I agree, Josh. I think it's on the one hand easy to look past. I think on the other hand, it's easy to berate ourselves about as well. And yeah, the finding the sweet spot is where I try to take the decency book. That we recognize that we're part of a larger environment that we often think is out there somewhere and simply an object for us to utilize. Recognizing that's not the way it is, right? We're all part of it, and we have effects on various creatures, and they have effects on us and how we live our lives, without getting to the point where it becomes impossible to move through the world because of the worries that one has about the effects you're going to have on other non-human animals.
Yeah. And that sweet spot that you mentioned, you know, does that connect with, say, like in Buddhism, the middle way, or Aristotle's philosophical mean? You know, does that connect there? And
it's a good question. Buddhism can be taken, Josh, in so many different directions, right? I mean, yeah, at one end you have the Jainists who don't want to harm any, sweep the sidewalk before they walk, because they don't want to harm any animals, right? And then on the other hand, you have people who think of Buddhism as just, I'm going to meditate in the office for 15 minutes so I'm more productive, right? So I think it does have a certain sense of middle way in Buddhism. Aristotle, I think it's complicated, because he talks about, well, he doesn't use the term the doctrine of the mean, that came later, right? But the idea of hitting the sweet spot, not too much, not too little, on the one hand, can seem like that's the sweet spot. On the other hand, it can become a project that, and this is the worry that people have around Aristotle, that I'm not hitting the sweet spot. And so for him, the sweet spot is a project that you need to take up. Right? For me, as I'm talking about the sweet spot in the context we were talking about it a moment ago, it's on the one hand acknowledging, in the term you use, which I really like, but on the other hand, not castigating yourself about what you're missing.
How do you think about, in the way of widening circles, just in general, like what comes to mind around actually doing that? And maybe not, you know, extreme examples. We've talked about Heracles circles that were, you know, gradually these concentric circles. You know, Einstein's talked about widening circles of compassion and things like that. But is there anything that comes to mind that helps you, you know, at least in some small way, widen your circle?
Well, the image that I, as I use it, Josh, comes from my reading of Hume. And so Hume thinks, and I think there's a lot to be said for this, Hume thinks that the core of our emotional lives lies in sympathy, the sympathy we have. And the idea then is to extend the sympathy, right? That's how our moral lives become richer or more nuanced, by extending sympathy. And that's where the idea of the circles came, right? Because I can think, okay, here's a stopping point, the strangers that I have on face-to-face with, here's a stopping point, and other human beings, here's a stopping point, other animals. So the idea of the circles came to me as a set of stopping points that one might arrive at in the course of extending sympathy. But if we go back to the notion of sympathy, then sympathy can be one of those things that we utilize in extending our moral concern. And it can happen in lots of ways. So for instance, there are all kinds of outrages going on in our world, and we read about them. We can't address every outrage. That's where we're going to wind up castigating ourselves. So I had worked on Palestinian rights for a number of years. I have a friend who lives in on the West Bank. And I said, look, if I got you some money, could you use it for some folks who are getting harmed in Gaza? Could I have given more? Sure. Could I have ignored it? Sure. But the idea is that I recognize here's something I can reasonably do. And maybe because I had been in 1989, I had been to the West Bank and Gaza, I had met people there, right? I had a certain sympathy that I might not have had in other cases. But as far as decency goes, I don't have to have that kind of sympathy for everybody, right? I can recognize the harm, but not feel sympathy to the point where I think I should do something about this. So I think sympathy is an element of this. But I think also just, and this can be difficult and depressing sometimes, just keeping up with the world, that seeing what's happening around, and then asking at certain points, is there something that I can push my circle on a little bit to reach a place that I might not have reached otherwise?
Yeah. And it seems like in the way of what might stand in the way, the moral purist perspective might lead you to think, what good is this small amount going to do? This much, you know, it needs to be some sort of huge grand gesture. So it's like the moral decent approach, actually, it seems like it would lead you to take action more often than not.
Yeah, I think that's right, Josh. And you've touched on something that's, I think, really important for a number of folks in Gen Z. I'm teaching a climate crisis course now, right? But it's environmental ethics, but I teach it simply as a climate crisis course. And there is a good bit of despair among people who are 18, 20, 22. I mean, you read about the news, I see it day to day with my students. And one of the things that I tell them is, look, you feel like you're not going to have an effect. You may have an effect. Some of you may have a little effect, right? But there's another question you want to ask. And this is where the decent life aspect of it comes in. What kind of person do I want to be? Right? Even if I may not change anything, what do I want to be, the person that gives up in despair? Or do I want to be a person that tries what I can to make things a little better, and it may work and it may not, right? That's where the decency comes in. So in trying to be that person, then you can move away from some of the sense of despair, right? Because you're not judging yourself in that consequentialist way by how much you do or don't change the world. You're judging yourself by the kind of person you try to be, and that would bring us back a bit to Aristotle. So the some of the kind of effects you would like to have in being that kind of person, which may or may not work out.
Well, I have a great deal of appreciation of your work in the world, you know, not only as a philosophy professor for decades now, but also work as a consultant on The Good Place. I'm curious now, as you think about it, you know, decades later and your experience in philosophy, what have you learned about spreading these, you know, philosophical ideas, if you will, to the, you know, non-philosophy majors or non-students that are in your class?
Yeah, a couple of things, Josh. I mean, one thing I have found, aside from the extent to which it's going to make them a better person or something like that, is these ideas are fascinating. They're great to talk about. And I get excited. I get in the class, I get excited. And the students get excited. And as they get excited, they start to think these are ideas worth thinking about. And that excitement, I think, can help translate into them taking up some of the ideas. Just the excitement of turning it over and looking at some way that someone might have an example that doesn't fit what they're thinking how they might change their view or rearrange it to take that into account. But they get involved in that. But as they're getting involved in it, they're getting involved in more thinking. And as they get involved in more thinking, it becomes a little bit a part of who we are. So to go back to Aristotle again, right? For Aristotle, who we are is largely a product of habituation, right? It's the things that we do that help make us who we are. All right, and I think over recent research in the formation of neurons and synapses, I think a lot of neurologists have come to the conclusion that, whether they say it this way or not, is that Aristotle's right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Habituation is how we become who we are. So people get habituated to thinking about these issues, and that becomes a bit of who they are. But the other thing is invitation, rather than people not measuring up. Here's something you could do. Here's something you could think about. What would you do, right, if you were to take this perspective seriously? What's one thing you might do? In my class tomorrow on the climate crisis, I gave them a short assignment to think about when they grew up, what's one thing that happened in their local environment that might be brought forward to use to help adapt or mitigate relative to the climate crisis. And that's one thing, and it's local, but they think about it, and then that becomes a possibility for them.
Well, I love it, and I'm really grateful for your time. I'm glad you're able to come on the podcast and share your time and wisdom. And sometimes I feel a little bad asking this big question to someone that's been teaching philosophy their whole life, but I'm going to do it anyway. How do you define or think about wisdom in daily life, Todd?
Good. Josh, well, before I address that, let me say that this has been a pleasure, right?
Great.
Talking with somebody who's thoughtful and intelligent and has background about these questions is always exciting for me, right? And I appreciate, right, your approaching me about it, right? Now, as the question, let me talk about one piece of it. Remember, I've been throughout this discussion, I've been pluralist, saying it doesn't reduce to a single thing. There are different aspects. And I'm going to go pluralist on this as well and just say that rather than saying what is wisdom in everyday life, what's one aspect of wisdom in everyday life? And I think one particularly now that's important is openness. Openness to others, right? Gandhi once insisted, and I say this a lot in my classes, Gandhi insisted, nobody's got all the truth. Right? Nobody's got a corner on it. And so if we are open, which doesn't mean we have to just accept anything anybody tells us, if we're open to others, which is part of recognizing that there are other people exist with their perspectives, I think we are less likely to be wound up in our own views and our own echo chambers. And in this time and place, that seems to me an important element of wisdom. Maybe not always, but certainly now.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, this has been great. Again, your book that we've been chatting about is A Decent Life. But I see you've got a new book coming out, and I was wondering if you could take a minute and maybe share a bit about that with the listeners.
Yeah, so the new book, here we go from decency to extremity. The new book is called Should We Go Extinct? And it basically asks the question of, are we as a species causing more harm than we're contributing to the world? And the way I approach it is I talk about, first, here are the things that humans bring to the world that other animals can't, or at least that they can't to the extent in the ways that we do. And then I talk about the various harms that we do through things that everybody's going to be aware of, you know, factory farming, deforestation, climate crisis, scientific experimentation, things like that. And then without saying, okay, here's where that falls, here's where that tilts, say, look, regardless of where you think that tilts, there are things that we can do to make our existence on the planet more justifiable. And I talked about some of the approaches to depopulation, to the climate crisis, to things like that, that people can think about individually and can think about in terms of campaigns that will make us better resonance of the planet, if I can put it that way. And so I'm pushing what many people will think at the end are things that would be good to do independent of the question of whether we should go extinct or not. But once you add that question, there's a certain urgency, a certain moral urgency that comes about. Look, if we're not going to do anything to make things better on the planet, right? Are we deserving of our place here, right? And once we raise that as a live question, then I think these other recommendations become more pressing for us.
Nice. And if I see correctly, that comes out this summer, August, is that right?
It comes out August 6th, Crown Publishing. A beautiful little cover. They gave me two covers, and they said, which one do you want? And I picked the wrong one, and they told me, no, that's the wrong one we're picking. And they were right.
Nice. Well, we'll link that in the show notes as well. And again, thank you so much, Todd May. Thank you for coming on In Search of Wisdom.
Thanks, Josh. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the In Search of Wisdom podcast. I hope you found something useful for daily life. If so, I encourage you to put what you heard into practice. If you're interested in more tools for the art of living, consider subscribing to Perennial Meditations on Substack. By becoming a member, you'll help support the project and gain access to our podcasts, meditations, and courses. Until next time, be wise and be well.